Welcome back to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt, usually. At least contingently, adjacently.
Today is a more of an adjacent Pitt.
Yeah.
But that's fine, you know?
We're
back at it. We did the craziest route to this podcast. Do Ocean's 11, his most popular film. Take a month and then come back with a film that does not star him.
Yeah.
I was trying to explain to someone that decision the other day and I realized I actually can't explain
it. No, inexplicable, illogical. But that's okay. We'll find a way over the course of this recording to justify
it. Well, you know.
It doesn't even need to be justified.
No, exactly. We do what the fuck we want, Dan. I do have Brad Pitt news. Do you have Brad Pitt news in the month?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So, for a while now, I have followed this Instagram page called Brad Pitt_the man.
Okay.
And it's a Brad... I follow quite a few of these. I follow one on Twitter too. And mostly they just post Brad Pitt, like, glamour shots.
So I think I might... You know what? I actually think I might have seen... And I thought I had saved it. I was looking for it before the podcast and couldn't find it. If this is the thing you're thinking of, great. If not...
We've got two Brad Pitt newses. So there's this one on Instagram in particular, Brad Pitt the man, that mostly posts Brad Pitt glamour shots, but ages ago, maybe even end of last year, did this bracket, March Madness style bracket, where the page asked Brad Pitt fans to vote which Brad Pitt movie was better than the other, and then created a kind of ranked list of all of the Brad Pitt movies. A lot of it will not surprise you, like Dark Side of the Sun was last. Do you know what was 13th of every film that Brad Pitt has ever been in?
I mean, that's an insane question, Joseph.
Maybe you know.
Cutting Class?
7 years in Tibet.
Oh.
Which we, out of sight, said.
Yeah, the worst.
One of the worst films maybe I've ever seen.
And a terrible Brad Pitt performance. Definitely. Unanimous.
So Brad Pitt, the man, the Instagram page, said this. Okay, for me it's a giant reach, presumably meaning that this film is so high.
Yeah.
But I must tell you that my biggest surprise since I created this account was to find out how much this movie is beloved by Brad Pitt's fan base. It's unbelievable. I couldn't have ever imagined. I agree it is unbelievable.
Yeah, that's the right response. That's baffling. Because also, it's not... Unless it's just contrarianism. There's no reason
to enjoy Pitt.
Because it's not the Pitt of any other film. There's no... You don't see him the kind of way you see elements of Fight Club Pitt in Ocean's 11 or, you know, Seven Pitt in some of his other cop dramas. You don't see any of...
No.
That's just an anomalous Pitt.
What do you want out of Brad Pitt?
The terrible accent. A truly objectively terrible accent.
It may be.
A really boring film.
Yes. David Thewlis? Maybe Pitt, the yang to Pitt seeing is Thewlis. What was your Brad Pitt piece of information?
I had a really beautiful Instagram image of Pitt in drag.
Yeah. Fight Club with the glove.
I had never seen it before.
And the white glasses and his head shave?
He had an earring in this one. I haven't been able to retrieve it.
Is that the one that you're thinking of?
You know what? That's not the photo.
Whoa.
But that is... That looks like...
There's a lot of
shoot. It's not that.
Wow.
It's a different photo.
Dan's got I'll see if I can find it. I think it might
like it might be that shoot. I saved it somewhere. I'll see if I can retrieve it.
Yeah, find it and we'll post it to the socials. Yeah, there's this very famous photo shoot of Pitt that I'm pretty sure was La Chapelle. Around the time of Fight Club, where he's... Okay,
that makes sense.
Yeah, shaved completely and very muscular and in an incredible sparkle dress. If you can hear the news blare, we're back recording in my house and the person next door has their radio very loud. So at the top of every hour, I hear that news blare. And I have to say it's a little bit torturous. No, I don't mind the sound of voices through the walls. But the news blare is scary for the passing of time.
Yeah.
That when I'm working here, I'll hear the blare, and then 5 minutes later, it'll be another blare. And I'll be like, no, there's simply no way. Yeah, it's been depressing. What have you been up to in your life for the last month, Dan?
I have been... I've had some time off teaching, which has been extremely good. I haven't watched as many films as I would have liked to watch. I will tell you some films I've watched recently, though.
Mm-hmm.
Just the other night, Do the Right Thing.
You watched it? For the first time.
Yeah.
Oh, Dan, finally.
Yeah.
One of the best films ever made.
Total masterpiece.
Yeah.
Perfect. Like, an extraordinary... Because I'd seen Black... Shamefully, the only other Spike Lee films I've seen is Black Klansman.
Maybe my least favourite of his.
I also saw it in... I may have been done a disservice by seeing it at a packed Sydney Film Festival screening with an extremely white audience who were laughing at all the wrong parts.
I remember that. I think I was in the same screening.
I think this was before we met, actually. Yeah. But it was... That made it hard.
Yeah.
And I wonder if seeing it again, I would find things to like in it.
I don't but love it.
Do the Right Thing. Just a complete vision... Like, totally, yeah, totally beautiful. The way in which all the characters operate.
Yeah.
The smallness of its setting and temporality.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying anything new. But also the tone unfolds is so elegant.
Yeah. The first half is just the definition of a hangout movie. That's just like, here are these people, and they're just living their lives. And then the way it strikes.
Also, if someone... I didn't know. I knew what it was about broadly. I kind of knew the same with the Air Jordans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I guess I knew it as a hangout film. But no one told me that, like, if you made that film tomorrow, people would be like, oh, wow, this is a super relevant film.
I think it was the New York Times, some review, there was genuine fretting in the media, like, this film will prompt riots. Like, this is a dangerous film to have play. And I mean, I think it holds all of its power still, right?
Definitely. I found, like, yeah, the ending especially just extraordinary.
I was
going to
say, the spoiler, some light spoiler warning for the end of Do the Right Thing. The fact that is a film that trepidatiously suggests, like, maybe we can rebuild, but in, like, very guarded terms.
Yeah.
It's kind of unrivaled in cinema, I think. Like, very few people would be audacious enough to try and be like, let's suggest that we can move forward together, but let's be kind of puzzled as to what that would actually look like.
I will also tell you, which you'll appreciate, that on the night I watched that, we were deciding between that and Song to Song, and we opted for Do the Right Thing.
Terrence Malick's Song to Song. Are you ever going to watch it? You should watch it.
I'm interested. I can see. It's funny. I watched the trailer for that and Knight of Cups because I've seen like two Malick films and really like them both. But watching the trailer for those made me concerned. Like I understand why.
Perfume adverts.
So I will watch them, but because I love. Yeah, I love. Badlands.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen Days of Heaven? Is that the other Malick you've seen?
No, I haven't. It's just The Hidden Life, the most recent film, I think is extraordinary. Even if some of its cinematography
is
it took me a while to get used to. I'll say that, but it's a transcendent film.
I still haven't seen Hidden Life. Life
it's
is
really
too
good.
Short.
It's a long film.
Hidden Life is too long, and my life is too short.
And I also watched... I visited Brisbane. I managed to get there just in the...
A stressful time.
A really stressful time for me. Because I was visiting my parents in the period in which that was permitted. But I was still anxious about getting on a plane. So that really... But I'm glad I got up there and I watched with my parents The Devil and Daniel Webster.
Mm.
Wonderful film. Weird film. Like, super Lynchian film from the 40s?
I think it's
early
the 40s.
Early 40s, maybe?
Yeah. Super expressionistic.
Also a German filmmaker who, I would recommend Devin Daniel Webster. And I also watched for the second time Heaven's Gate with them, the film. But wait, Heaven's Gate? It's the one about the pet cemetery.
Errol Morris's Heaven's Gate, the documentary.
Yeah.
Is that called
Heaven's Gate?
Dan, don't.
Not at Eternity. Eternity's Gate is the. Or is that something else?
No, are they both called Heaven's Gate? 1980, so Heaven's Gate is the Cimino epic that famously bankrupted a studio.
What am I thinking of?
So you are thinking of...
At Eternity's Gate? No, is that...
Gates of Heaven.
Gates of Heaven.
It's the Morris.
Wonderful.
Great.
I think I've been telling people I watched Heaven's Gate. Gates of Heaven.
Great.
A truly, I would say, I was watching it and it gave me all the feelings I want from cinema and art. It's just a truly perfect film.
I love Morris. He's all of his stuff I find like that, like totally fulfilling in a really deep way. Although I haven't seen his, he made a show recently about some guy who was getting experimented on by the FBI.
Oh, that's right.
Wormwood is the show, I think.
That looks interesting. But I
should watch it.
He also comes across... There's an interview with him on Criterion about the Gates of Heaven. and he comes across perfectly. Like, just the kind of guy you would want to make that film. Because I think there's some anxiety watching a film which is about the creation of and success of or failure of pet cemeteries in California, that he's kind of looking down on the people or there's some kind of cartoonishness to the people he's filming. But I think the interview with him kind of puts that to bed, which made me very happy. There's also a great interview, like brief shot of Werner Herzog talking about how he said he'd eat his shoe.
And he did. Yeah. There's a film of it. Have you ever seen Werner Herzog eats his shoe? I think it's also on Criterion Channel. And check it's just out. Herzog, like, stewing the shoe. There's also some story that, like, Herzog and Morris were trying to find out something about their ancestry. And they were trying to work out who, like, Morris's great-great-grandfather was. So Herzog was like, let's go dig up the body and, like, get it genetically tested. And Morris was apparently like, okay... And Herzog, like, set a time and day, and Herzog rocked up with this shovel.
That's
and
very funny.
And then Morris didn't.
What a man.
What a man. I love Werner.
What about you? What have you been up to, Joseph?
You know, I've been working. I re-dyed my hair pink.
This I is really the second like this dye.
The problem is pink fades so quickly.
But I'll tell you why that kind of works in this situation. Because you have the roots coming through... The fading allows for it to be more textured as opposed to just kind of two-tone, which I think...
I have, like, a blonde mullet at the moment, but, like, a pink top. It's getting a little crazy.
When was the last time you had an actual haircut?
A long time. Yeah. I'm growing it way out. I'm going crazy. I'm turning 30 in a couple of months, so this is, like, some version of a... What is it? A third life crisis? I won't live long. Maybe this is the midlife crisis. Have I watched anything good? I don't...
You've been watching the Fassbinder films.
I did basically all the Fassbinders and had a great time because he's the premier artist of 21st century, 20th century. I really loved those. And the other day I watched one of the 20 best films ever made, Babe, Pig in the City.
You know, I've only seen Babe. I haven't seen Babe, Pig in the City.
You and most people, because Babe, sure Pig in the City was a flop. Babe, Pig in the City is an insane film.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece, but it operates... I was trying to explain it to Brianna the other day. It operates at such a level of emotional intensity that, like, Babe, Pig in the City starts, and I'm on the verge of tears.
Yeah.
And I remain on... And not because anything sad is happening, but because it's so emotionally overwhelming. I'm like, you know when you're a child and you're ushered into a loud room with lots of grown-ups, and you just kind of... always feel like you're gonna lose it. That's Babe, Pig in the City.
I think I remember, because I loved Babe as a child, I remember that maybe seeing the trailer, maybe seeing a poster for Babe, Pig in the City, and my sense at the time, even though I was the target market, I feel, was, well, that looks too scary for me. I think that
it
was
is
the,
too
and
scary
that was,
for children.
Yeah.
There
I think
is...
I had a kind of Return to Oz vibe about
yes,
it.
Yes, it very much does. There is a scene... which I had forgotten how shocking it is, where Babe is being chased by a very scary dog that's broken free.
Yeah, that kind of Pinocchio aesthetic I hate that lostness of a small defenseless
Pinocchio,
creature.
The OG animated Pinocchio, is George Miller, the director of Babe, Pig in the City's favourite film.
That makes sense.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, Babe is being chased by a dog that's on a chain, that's on a stake, and the stake has come out of the ground, so the dog is chasing Babe. And then Babe jumps into the water and the dog has tangled itself in its chain and jumps too. And so what happens is the dog is drowning upside down, hanging off the chain off the side of a bridge with just its head under the water while Mozart is playing and Babe is watching in slow motion.
Does the dog die?
No, Babe. Okay. Babe saves the dog.
That's good.
But it's
still...
It's dragged out. There are all these dogs watching the drowning dog.
Goodness.
It's...
Like the scene in Toy Story 3, I want to say, where they're all approaching the fiery
the furnace.
Pit.
But like, scarier. Because in Toy Story 3, it's kind of this melancholy goodbye, whereas Babe, Pig in the City throughout kind of feels like... You know, I invoke it all the time, but that Wes Craven quote about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that it feels like a murderer stole a camera and made a film, still applies to Babe, Pig in the City. You know what else I think it applies to?
Husbands.
The film that we are here to discuss today.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about aspirins? Have we decided yet?
Good question.
We've talked about it for a long time.
It's been on... I think Cassavetes has been a figure on the outskirts of this podcast. And although our conversations outside the podcast and inside the podcast sometimes blur for me, I think for us, we've talked... I mean, I watched... You recommended and I watched Mikey and Nikki, which has come up a few times, which is the Cassavetes fork.
Yeah. Not directed by Cassavetes. No. Directed by Elaine May. Whereas Husband stars and is directed by Cassavetes.
And they have very similar feelings. I looked it up. Mikey and Nikki's like 6 years later.
Yeah. They do have extremely similar. Although, I mean, we'll get into it. What I think the key difference is. But I also think, which is maybe the explanation of why we're doing this movie now, is Cassavetes is a good analog to Pitt. I think they have quite similar performing styles. I think they're similarly antic. Although the weird thing about Husbands is Cassavetes kind of gives himself the least meaty role in this film. We can go into that too. But the big similarity, I think, between Cassavetes and Pitt, and kind of the one of the most famous things about Cassavetes, is he was a very handsome leading man who... He was in some show called Johnny Staccato, which was like a detective show. So he, like, the mainstream knew who he was. He's famously the husband in Rosemary's Baby.
A perfect name as well.
John Cassavetes.
It's the best name.
Isn't it? It really is. And, like, such a handsome dude and such a charismatic dude.
Magnetic.
Yeah.
In the way that latter-day Pitt is.
Yes.
Although I've only seen latter-day Cassavetes, I guess. Or at least only him over, like...
You haven't seen Rosemary's Baby?
No, I have seen Rosemary's Baby, actually. How old is he
He's pretty young in that, I think. Okay. Actually, is that true? Maybe that's not true. He died very young. Okay. So we're talking about a kind of a sadly short creative era. I think the big thing is that both Pitt and Cassavetes are leading men who use their leading man status to fund and finance off-kilter projects. Well, you see Pitt does it now with his starring in these movies that maybe would not get made at the budget that they were made for unless he was involved. Yeah. So something like Assassination of Jesse James or even Killing Them Softly. Like, these are movies that are weird, not commercial movies that get greenlit because they're like, oh, Brad Pitt's going to star. Yeah.
Even Ad Astra, you look at that script and is that made without Pitt? Probably not.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to give... I was going to say, when I was rewatching this film, I was like... What does a four-sentence game version of this film looks like?
If you're one way of asking that is, how do you stretch it out to four sentences?
Yes! Because you could do the plot in a single sentence.
Yes.
Right?
Like, yeah. After the death of a friend, three men go on an extremely long blender that takes them from New York to London.
Yes, and that's it.
Yeah.
That's literally
and
it.
And back, I guess you could say for
two of them
come back.
Because the film is, as you say, a long movie... But it's actually only comprised in
eight scenes or something?
Yeah, which is so Cassavetes.
Okay.
His films often feel like improvisation exercises that are kind of spilling out of control.
Yeah. You're not sure whether this whole time you're watching it, whether they are acting drunk or are actually drunk, these men on screen.
So the film starts with the funeral of this friend. It actually starts with, like, photos of them together with the friend.
Great. Perfect opening.
Yeah, truly perfect opening.
Yeah.
And then there are these three men, played by Peter Falk, John Cassavetes, and Ben Gazzara, perfectly cast each of
them. Definitely. Who is Ben Gazzara? I feel like I know the name, maybe, but...
So he was a Cassavetes guy, like Falk. Gazzara is the lead of The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, like a great John Cassavetes film. But otherwise, he kind of had this weird stint. Have you seen Dogville, the Von Trier film? Yeah. He's in Dogville.
Oh, he's quite old, right?
Yeah. It was one of his last films, I think that's true. There's like a making-of documentary about Dogville. And one of the things they had on the set of that film was like a little booth, which you could go in and record yourself kind of leaving video diary stuff. And Gazzara only came into the booth once, and he was just like, I swore to myself I'd never work with another crazy director, and here I am. So I think he had a rough time. The three main characters are fairly similar in that they are toxic straight white men.
Yes, it took me a little while to distinguish Cassavetes and Gazzara.
Really?
In the beginning.
Yeah.
Or just like not... Just every now and then I'd be confused as to who was playing. And certainly their characters.
Yes. At the beginning, almost interchangeable.
Mm.
But then Gazzara is scary. Is the scary one. But he plays a character called Harry. The only other thing maybe you'd immediately know him from is The Big Lebowski. He plays Jackie Treehorn, the porn guy.
It's so long since I've seen that film.
Okay. You know, there's that scene where Treehorn is on the phone and the dude is watching him and Treehorn writes down something on a notepad and then walks out of the room and the dude comes over and like scribbles on the next page to see what it was. That's and Treehorn just drew like a caricature of a dude with a really big penis.
Yeah.
It's a great chunk in that film. But yeah, that's it. Like Gazzara is just in a lot of 70s and 80s stuff that just doesn't exist anymore. Whereas Peter Falk is obviously Columbo.
Yeah.
Columbo himself. And where does Columbo slot into Husbands, actually?
I think it's post.
Because Husbands is 70. And Columbo, I think, was throughout the 60s?
I thought Columbo was post. I thought Columbo was 70s.
Oh, really? I gotta look now.
Please.
Have you ever seen Columbo?
Only segments. I feel like I'd really like it.
It's a great. It's so good.
I really want to watch it. I actually went to a, I might have even mentioned this on the podcast before, like an academic forum thing about Columbo in which some husband stuff was brought up.
Mm.
But it made me, that we watched in that some very long sequences from Columbo and it made me very compelled.
Columbo starts in 68.
Oh,
so Falk has been on the show for 2 years. So he's probably maybe better known than Cassavetes almost.
I mean, I'm sure you'd get to this regardless, but does Husbands make money?
Well, so this is the thing about Cassavetes that we were kind of briefly talking about off mic, that Cassavetes is often called the father of American independent movies because he is really the first guy to do what is now a very common model of making movies that are not attached to a studio. So like truly independent. So you're not getting the money from a major studio. You're cobbling the money together and you're making movies that way. It had been done, like Ed Wood, famously, the famous like B movie director, would like get money from dentists, and they would say to him, "You have to put a giant squid in the movie." Sure. So that's why Ed Wood movies are so strange, because like six other people are directing what happens. But his films were always extremely cheap, Cassavetes, which meant that his films didn't have to make very much money, and I think he kind of considered them loss leaders.
Should we go through the plot a bit more in a bit more depth?
Let's do it.
I think it's just so, because I think this is a film that fewer people will have seen. Mm-hmm. I would cautiously recommend this film, depending on who the person is I'm recommending it to. I would not recommend this film to anyone.
You didn't like it?
I liked it a lot.
Okay.
But I found it excruciating.
It is excruciating. It's actively exhausting.
It was hard to watch. I watched it over 3 sittings.
How did you divide it up?
It's a very good question. So I thought maybe, I think like 40 minutes an hour, 40 minutes roughly.
Oh, sure. So you did.
So first stop is like in the middle of this, or at the end of the singing scene.
Which is, is that the toughest scene in the film?
It was going so long for so long. No, I don't think it is the toughest film.
You don't?
I think the toughest film scene in the film is in the hotel bedroom in kind of the second last sequence.
Oh, with one of them? Cassavetes and the tall blonde girl? Yeah, that is pretty rough.
I think the first 15 minutes of this film are extraordinary and anyone should watch them. Or first 15, 20 minutes.
But then just duck out?
Well, yeah, because it's not excruciating, really. I mean, so you have the funeral scene, which is really beautifully handled. As you say, it opens with the photographs. It's very funny. Like, the dialogue is almost so naturalistic that it doesn't feel real sometimes, which is quite the achievement. But in the funeral scene, also very funny. And then as soon as, like, post-funeral, they're kind of upset both that their friend has died, but they feel aggrieved by the way the funeral was handled or something. And one of them, maybe Gazzara, says, "I'm going to get very drunk."
Yeah, it is Gazzara.
I think they're on the subway and then they're playing basketball. You just hear these kind of like, the most beautiful scenes in this film are when they're like roughhousing in streets. So there's often these distant shots of them, maybe just shot on the actual street with civilians around, was my sense.
You can see people looking at the camera.
And these guys are just like school children, pushing each other, running across the road, jaywalking, roughhousing, right? And it's transcendent.
In a cold New York, they're all wearing gloves.
Yeah, they're all wearing black, so they're all kind of interchangeable.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And that's the thing I think the film does that's also quite funny in terms of its time crunch, because maybe before you watch this film, you hear like, oh, this is guys going on a bender. But what actually happens is you get the funeral, And then the first 24 hours of the bender are compressed into like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
You just see them at a bar and then you see them elsewhere. And then they go to a gym and you're like, oh, it must be the next morning. Yeah.
They try to go to a strip club.
Yes.
But it's closed.
The film is just in these spurts where like a lot of is compressed into very short scenes. And then scenes that could be completely dispensable go on for 40, 50 minutes. Yeah. Like an the film is, as you say, basically three scenes, including the one that we alluded to before as being difficult, which is you're just suddenly in a bar and you pick up contextually that they are sitting kind of with strangers and they have challenged everyone to kind of sing a song and the person who sings the best song wins. And it's all going quite well. And then this woman starts singing a song and the three of them for 15, 20 minutes just torment her. Just they decide that she's bad. Although she doesn't seem to be worse than any of the other singers.
And the scene's been already, it feels like going on for too long. And then you had told me before I watched this, or maybe as I'd started to watch it, that this is a film you watch in the background, which I both really understand and find incomprehensible. Because it is a film that you could absolutely tune in and out of at any moment and understand its aesthetic and meaning. But also, just the worst people.
Yes.
Just real, real grim representation of the human condition.
But some love there, right?
Definitely.
We were going to draw it in eventually. Maybe now's the place. One of the most famous things about Husbands, which we definitely have talked about before, is that Gazzara, Fork, and Cassavetes appeared on the Dick Cavett Show to promote this film while very drunk and basically gave a performance on that talk show that is indistinguishable from the way they are in this film.
It is as if that is an off cut from the film.
Yes. Even in the way they kind of off play, like throughout the film, the dynamic of the three men is that at any one time, one of them is being very hostile.
Yeah.
One of them is being like quite melancholy and the other thinks it's all funny. And they kind of swap through that roles with Gazzara usually being the scary one, Fork usually being the tragic one, and Cassavetes just laughing. And they're like that in the interview.
I actually haven't watched that since I've seen this film, but I'll have to go back.
Fucking hell.
Singing scene, they are like in a bar with 20 people and these people like, someone starts singing a song, everyone sings, or like, or people listen. Sometimes people sing along. There seem to be unclear rules about the situation. Again, often the conditions of scenes aren't really explained, but this woman is, and it's not just that they are teasing her, but they are harassing her.
Touching her when she doesn't
touching
want to be
her,
touched.
Kissing her.
She keeps saying, I'm scared
of you. But she's also obviously very drunk as well, because she kind of like is alternating between passivity and resistance in a way that suggests confusion. And that is so hard to watch. And that's not the only time that kind of thing happens in the film.
No.
It's such a showcase of what we take for granted in cinema. Around like, it just, like, you just expect, you just keep expecting it not to be going, like, not, I was halfway through this and I was like, well, this has gone on far too long. It's really
you don't like so how long out. It goes for?
I don't know, but that's the question of this film, right? It's like, what does it mean to like something? I was thinking about a lot of, we often talk about my dislike, my problems with violence, or the way in which it makes me uncomfortable, let's say, in cinema. And that the feeling I have when watching a violent film is basically indistinguishable from the feeling of watching this film, which is not to say that I therefore discount the artistic merit, but it just, I'm not having a good time as such.
Sure.
But I can recognise it as obviously. It doesn't mean I can't recognise the quality.
The film has at least two long oases where you're just getting like very unpleasant, difficult behaviour. Which is also something that I wanted to bring up on that we kind of mentioned briefly before, that like, you made the point. I think a lot of people talk about Cassavetes as a very naturalistic filmmaker.
Mm.
He has this reputation, which is untrue. Everyone associated has said that it's untrue. People kind of think that the way Cassavetes made films was entirely improvisational, and everyone just got there and kind of just did. These are like tightly scripted films with like camera work that's very deliberate. He did not improvise at all. These are really tightly wound scenes. So I think not only was he like he literally didn't operate like a documentary filmmaker. I don't think this movie is naturalistic.
No, it's not.
Which is weird because there's nothing sci-fi, there's no non-naturalistic elements, but it operates at such an emotional frequency that it doesn't feel real.
Yeah.
And he deliberately does things that make it feel less real that you also mentioned, right? Like this sense that you'll just be dumped into a scene.
Yeah.
And you're like, where have we come from? What is going on?
There's a great moment where Gazzara is back in his office and then he leaves to meet. He like reluctantly leaves to meet Forca and Cassavetes. But as he's leaving, gets kind of lambasted by this set of men who both start like laughing at him and then speaking in these like extremely improbable voices.
Yes.
And it's just no explanation, no sense of context.
No. And then
and it's amazing.
And then Gazzara goes, let's go to London.
That's yeah.
So it's like a hat on a hat. Yeah. It's like another crazy thing happens. Yeah.
I actually haven't seen this film, so it's crazy that I'm bringing it up. But My Dinner with Andre is like a notoriously like conversational, like feels like a real conversation film, right? This, I assume this doesn't feel like
that. No, it doesn't. My Dinner with Andre is like sadder than people. I think sometimes people think that's kind of like a sedate film for your uncle that he'll fall asleep on at a 2 o'clock matinee. My Dinner with Andre is, it's more toothy than that.
Okay.
But it feels like two people hanging out.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie does not feel like human beings hanging out.
The scene that's after the singing, there's this extended vomiting scene, which is auditorily very challenging.
Yes, lots of puking. Yeah. And Gazzara can't puke and he's pissed off about it.
Yeah, and like gets challenged, seems like emasculated by the fact that he can't puke. Other stuff happens, they go to London. But then when they go to London, they go to a casino. They fly to London, there's like 10 seconds on a plane, they're at a casino. And this extended scene where they're playing craps, where they're like rolling dice and they're all, the casino is like totally quiet and you can only hear their table and you can only see them and they're rolling dice towards the camera, so there are other people around them but you never get a good look at them and they're all talking and kind of congratulating, and then there start to be some cuts, but like same shot or the same setup, it's all basically incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Like it's not, and it's not just incomprehensible in the way that someone who has had too much to drink might be incomprehensible, there's this like, as you say, heightened emotionality to it. There's just a constant hum that it's like, you can understand why someone would describe, and like why I said so naturalistic, that it doesn't feel naturalistic. It's like this, it's naturalism just turned all the way up.
Hyper reality.
Yeah.
To the point where it feels alien.
It's all id.
Yeah. I mean, I think this comes back to the fact that people underrate Cassavetes in this way. He also, the dialogue across all of his films is very odd. Like, I think the dialogue of this film is closest to like a Harold Pinter play.
Yeah.
There's just these constant language games. Like, it's basically scenes are just people rephrasing the same sentiment over and over. Like the singing scene, right? They're torturing this woman by being like, where's your heart? But they just spend like 20 minutes saying different variations of like, where's your
heart?
And
she's singing the same line again and again and again. It's like, it's a sensory assault. Yeah. The whole film is a sensory assault.
And it also comes back to maybe my favorite moment in the film. And that's not true. It's all like, I adore this film.
Yeah, I understand that.
At the craps scene, Fork has kind of just suddenly decided, which is another very Cassavetes thing. Yeah. Is people will just suddenly announce like, this is what's been that's driving me crazy.
Well, I haven't seen any other Cassavetes, but it happens so much in this film. Yeah, they just yell it.
Yeah.
There's a great, when they walk into the, they rush into the, it's raining, they get out of the cab when they arrive in London, they rush into the hotel lobby. I think it's Cassavetes just yells, wet!
Yeah.
And that's the scene, then like they cut to a new scene.
Yeah, because there is some discussion of the fact that like, Cassavetes' character just loves to scream, so will frequently just like, scream randomly. They apologize for it.
Which again, is not naturalistic.
No. But there's this... Fork decides that his problem is he's not good at sex and he doesn't have enough of it. So at the crap scene, there are these also quite excruciating scenes where he's walking around asking women to sleep with him, basically. And there's this...
Sort of, right?
He's trying to kind of hedge his bets. There's self-loathing
involved in there as well.
He doesn't want to say it because he doesn't want to be rejected.
Yeah.
And there's this one... The whole thing is a tight close-up between Fork and this older woman who's playing craps, who he kind of grabs and is saying like, we can go to my room, and like, and she turns and looks at him and we see her turning in the process because she's kind of had her back to us, and we see that she's older And presumably that's why Fork immediately recoils.
And she's very made up as well. So there's the sense of maybe from a distance, he's like,
And then she's suddenly going to him like, oh no, I'd love that. And she's propositioning him. And there's this long back and forth where he's going like, don't take touch your hand my, off hand. My hand. And she goes like, your hand's on my
hand.
And
that happens maybe 7 or 8 times, right? Just that exchange.
Yeah. Just this constant restatement of the same things over and over.
I watched it in, both because it's a 2.5-hour film and because of the emotional difficulty. I watched it, as I said, in 3 sittings. It would be really interesting to have the sensation of emerging from a cinema having watched this film.
Yes, I think a lot about seeing this in a cinema. Because I think also, like obviously I watch a lot of masterpieces or films that I consider masterpieces at home. And I think my biggest problem with watching stuff at home is like, whenever I want to, I can check how long this film has to go.
Oh, with husbands. It would feel like a 4-hour, 5-hour film, yes, maybe.
You'd feel insane. Because you'd be like, I don't know how much time has passed. Because I guess the other thing about why I love this film is, despite everything we've said, I do find it very watchable. Because of its kind of the nature of it being an onslaught, it's never boring.
No. You're always compelled, even if it's just by... It's funny because it has a lot of features that are associated with boredom, in that you are wondering when something will be over.
Mm.
But you're never wondering whether something will be over because you're not feeling anything in response to it. It's because you're feeling too much.
Yeah. Far too much. This is your first Cassavetes, right?
Yeah. What else should I watch?
Well, that's the thing, right? Like,
are they all like this?
Most of them. But with the difference that, like... So his best-known film is probably A Woman Under the Influence, which is a part of the story that we haven't mentioned yet because she's not in this film, is that Cassavetes was married to Gina Rowlands, very famous, very beautiful and very charming performer, and he would often cast her in movies and would direct her to some of the most transcendent performances in cinema. So she's in A Woman Under the Influence, which is a film about a woman having a breakdown, in which Fork is her husband. It similarly is like a series of very long scenes of her kind of losing her mind around his workmates and her like stressing about the kids. And similarly, this like high level of intensity, similarly this strange, like she acts in such an erratic way that you're kind of like, what is the problem? Like, is she just a kind of a suburban housewife who's been pushed too far? Or is this like an extreme personality disorder? But what I think a lot of people who like Cassavetes don't like about Husbands is that his other films that operate at that emotional intensity also have a lot of care and empathy for his characters. Like, A Woman Under the Influence is a love story and he loves the characters. Whereas there's so much repulsion in Husbands. There's so much self-loathing, I think.
It's funny. So I've watched... When did The Conversation come out? The Gene Hackman?
I think 74.
So I've watched in the last just few months, maybe a bit longer, but let's say that. I've watched 4 films from the 70s that really stick out to me. Actually, one is from 69. So Midnight Cowboy, which is 69, I think.
Conversation is 74.
Conversation, Husbands, and Mikey and Nikki, which is 76, I think. And all of them just have this such a depraved understanding of masculinity.
Yes.
Far more than is represented in almost any art today.
Yes.
It may be that culture in the 70s was far more toxically masculine, and it may be that we have a far more nuanced way of articulating our understanding of toxic masculinity today. But, oh boy, they knew the 70s, like... It's really interesting.
What that is part of is the fact that the 70s is kind of the birth of new Hollywood. And in fact, like, Conversation directed by Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola, who's a big new Hollywood director. And the thing about these directors was that they were young men who lived very excessive lives. Like, Scorsese is part of this new Hollywood too, right? And Taxi Driver is obviously a film in line with what we're talking about.
Main Street is kind of like that, right?
Exactly. And Scorsese famously... Like, you know, coke is a big part of his life and also his artistic worldview. So I think why you have those films is because you have men who are feeding into the worst aspects of the patriarchy, but have watched enough European movies to know that they should have some self-loathing about that. So you look at a film like Taxi Driver, I mean, all of Schrader's cinema too, right? Yeah. He wrote Taxi Driver. You look at The Conversation, and these are films made by people who behave in the same way as their main characters, but have, like, Ingmar Bergman in their ear being like, this is depraved, this is bad. And that's the sense I get from Husbands.
Yeah.
Which is why the Cavett interview is so crazy, right? Like, he embodied Cassavetes, you know, died of problems associated with his drinking. He is these characters. And so he... But that doesn't lead to him shooting it with empathy or care. It leads him shooting the proceedings with disgust.
Is there any... The scene where they're all playing basketball, in which they're all... They, like, either break in or find an empty YMCA type set up early in the film. And they're... But they're in their bender. And they're... Like, they've been joking about... I think Gazzara says he wanted to be a basketball player but wasn't tall enough.
Mm.
And so they're playing... But they're all terrible. That's kind of beautiful. That's yeah. a... That's, and that seems somewhat... Loving.
Affectionate.
I think that it turns in a scene we haven't really talked about, which is when Gazzara goes home and is violent towards his wife and violent towards his child, maybe his like grown or older teenage daughter.
And his wife's mother.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
The crazy thing is that Gazzara has always been the scary one, so you kind of hope that Cassavetes and Fork will kind of call him out, but there's a scene before that where they're saying, listen, if my wife talked to me that way, I just, you know, so like they're feeding into, they're not judging Gazzara.
Yeah, they're saying like he went home because he had to.
Yeah.
That's no way to live.
Yeah. It's that's a really tough scene.
I think that was the scene where I found I was most concerned about the film. Like, I was just... Then I was like, oh, this film isn't gonna...
It's not gonna be fun.
Like, it's not gonna be interspersing... Just having a fun time with some of the darker stuff. This is just a film that is interested in... darkness. Is it even a tragedy? I guess it's a tragedy.
I think it is.
Because it never... Does it ever show any... Like, it starts with a funeral.
Yeah.
You know? And it goes down from there.
Yeah. Yes, it does, and that's the other thing about this film, like, it only points downwards, yeah, right? Like,
so the final sequence, they bring in a series of women back into their hotel room in London, and, you know, it's not good.
It's also this craziness of, like, they treat these women extremely badly in a range of different ways.
It is, yeah.
And then Cassavetes and Fork talk to each other, and they're like...
They're falling in love with these women.
Which is very Cassavetes. Yeah. This very Cassavetes, like...
Which there's no evidence of that in the interactions with these women. In fact, it all points to the contrary.
No.
They basically all get rid of... They all tell these women to go fuck themselves, more or less.
And that's why you're laughing, right? Because it's insane. It's like retroactively explaining behavior that doesn't make sense at the time.
Yeah. It's not even really Freudian. It's because it doesn't seem to be...
There's no struggle.
Yeah, and there's no structure.
No.
I think... There is... Something I do want to say, though, is... At times, the film is quite funny. Cassavetes yelling out wet in the hotel lobby. The casino sequence, some of that is quite funny. One scene that has come to mind a few times in our conversation is when they arrive at the hotel room in London with the women, and Cassavetes calls up room service and is asking everyone what they want. He's like, what do you have with salads? What do you have in soups? Yeah. And he, like, describes the fact of people will have a double prawn cocktail. What does anyone want to drink?
Yeah. A Coca-Cola.
Yeah. That's very funny.
So this... And a kind of behind-the-scenes thing about this film is that Cassavetes thought it was a comedy. And there is apparently a cut that, like, almost no one has seen that's never been commercially released that is quote-unquote funny. Now, I don't...
Yeah.
I can't even picture what the funny version of this film looks like.
It can't be longer.
No. No.
It's not, it hasn't left stuff out.
No. Unless there's just like a laugh a minute, you know, seen at the custard pie factory or something.
Cutting room floor.
My only thought is that why people say that is Cassavetes thought he was making a comedy. They started shooting it and he was like, it took him a while to realize, like, actually, this isn't funny. But the tagline for the film when it was released is like, very confusing because it doesn't seem to speak to what the film is really about.
I feel like I had some idea of what this film was and I was still pretty shocked. Imagine walking into a cinema in 1970 not knowing what you were in for. Yeah. Oh, the guy from Columbo and Rosemary's Baby are in this movie.
Yeah.
About husbands, cool, like maybe a fun, quirky.
And the tagline is a comedy about life, death, and freedom.
I mean,
because it's about freedom in like a misogynistic way, right? The film touches on freedom, like freedom from your wife.
Yes.
Which is wild.
It's important that it's called husbands, right? It's not called men.
Yes. This is the poster too. It's just like all red and then like a them all smiling and laughing in a way that they almost never do in the film.
And if they do, you aren't laughing with them.
No. It's pointed.
You basically never laugh with the
characters. It is very good, I think. I think I said this about the Cavett interview on the podcast. I think one of the things about the film that is most kind of clear-eyed is it, more than any other film I've seen, it captures this very Pinterest game that men play based around rules. Do you know what I'm... this happened to me most at high school, that, like, bullies will do this thing where, like, they're tormenting you and they're making it seem like a joke.
Yeah.
But if you try and get in on the joke, if you try and laugh too, they'll be like, this isn't funny. Why is this funny to you? Right? This, like, very toxically male thing of, like, I know all the rules and you don't know any, and I can switch the rules
I'll move the boundaries so that it's impossible for you to access them.
Yeah. Sure. And there is a lot of kind of game playing in this film.
Mm.
A lot of language games, right? Like this scene with the vomiting, and what's happening is that Cassavetes and Fork are in a stall and Gazzara keeps trying to come in, and they keep kind of like icing him out.
This has to have three men. Right? Because it has to be about constantly switching alliances.
Yes.
As well. Although normally Fork and Cassavetes are together, kind of against or with Gazzara.
Yeah.
But the fact, like, the instability of that is really important.
I do wonder why. Do you agree that the Cassavetes character is kind of the least there?
He's the least defined.
Yeah. He just laughs a lot.
Yeah. Even though you never see... Fork's is the only family you never see, I think.
Hmm.
He looks very distinctive, Peter Fork. He's got he's one of the most recognizable figures and faces in cinema.
Yeah.
I think. And so that does a lot of work for him. But he also, as you mentioned him earlier, has been the kind of tragic one. He has this melancholia that kind of floats around with him that never lets up, that is more stable, I think. And then Gazzara has this meanness and kind of unsympathetic
scariness.
Scary, yeah.
Genuinely quite scary.
Which, yeah.
And Cassavetes is the one on the side, kind of just laughing.
Yeah.
Maybe my favorite Cassavetes. Like, if I haven't made this clear enough, like, Cassavetes is, like, a hugely important creative figure for me. I, like, draw a lot of... I watch his movies all the time. His second-to-last film is maybe my favorite, and it's called Love Streams.
I don't think I've heard of it.
Cassavetes plays a famous author, and Gina Rowlands, his wife, plays his sister. And Cassavetes' character is kind of going off the rails, and the Rowlands character keeps trying to help him, but we gradually learn that she too has, like, severe issues. Like, there's a scene where she wants to pick him up a dog, because she's like, the thing that will make Cassavetes happy is if I get a dog. And then she goes to this kind of farm to get a dog, and also gets, like, a goat, a chicken, a llama. She's like, oh, he'll love that. And then she rocks up at Cassavetes' house with, like, 12 animals and immediately realizes, like, oh, you don't like this. And she's going, like, I'm so sorry, we'll send back the llama. Like, and the Cassavetes character in that film is also very... Cassavetes is very good. I think we said once on this podcast that he would be the actor who would do really well playing the Joker. And not, you know, because he has that, like...
Manic energy, right? Unpredictable. You wouldn't feel comfortable in a room with him.
No, as these characters.
Yeah.
There's a...
I've been rewatching 30 Rock since lockdown, and I'm still working my way through it. And there's a great Alec Baldwin line where he says, never go with a hippie to a second location. And you could say that about John Cassavetes. Don't go with him to a second location.
Yes. But in this film, in Love Streams, there's lots of, like, melancholy and sadness. And in the Cassavetes character, he's the least melancholic, right? Like,
yeah.
He doesn't seem sad.
So this is something I want to ask you about. Having seen this, because I think I'm not obviously especially concerned with intentionality, but I am interested in Cassavetes as a figure. And I'm wondering, like, so what, you've seen all his films, I've only seen Husbands. What is he interested in? Like, what is he trying to... Because it's so distinctive and it's so coherent. It's clearly, like, a particular strong angle on the world. But what does he have to... I'm not saying he needs to say something. I'm just really interested in, like, what does he have to say?
He thinks, and he has said very often in interviews, that, like, all he cares about is love. And that all of his movies are about love. And whereas I don't think that, to me, catches what is... Like, if I said to you, you should watch Husbands, it's about love, I would be deceiving you. You want to find out about love,
watch Husbands. Yeah. It's not. Yeah.
But I think it gets to the fact... He makes films that, like George Miller's masterpiece Babe in the City, kind of operate on an emotional level at such a frequency and pitch that they kind of feel like dreams. That's why I feel so weird about the way people talk about Cassavetes, because, like,
yeah,
I think he's even more Lynchian than someone like David Lynch. Yeah, like,
I think that's...
There's no structure, there's no sense of where things are going to go. People behave so unpredictably. You know, people would just see him as a surrealist if, like, one of the characters in this film was, like, dressed up as
or
a bunny.
Into a telephone or something.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But it's just as strange.
I agree. I think it has... I think that's what's interesting to me about this film. And I think that's one of the reasons, not in the near future, but I would want to watch Husbands a second time. So I think knowing that kind of helps.
Sure.
I feel like I've been having, like, more and more remembering long dreams recently. And this does have the logic of a long dream.
Yeah.
Because you're somewhere and then you're in the new place...
You're
and
in
then,
London?
Yeah, like, exactly. And that's fine. And you're in this, like... This, you know, this person who you don't really know is around. And this person got to this place and we're not really concerned with how. And this person is no longer with these people. And you don't really know what anyone's saying at any one point, but they're kind of giving you a general sense of their feeling or their, like, attitude. And also... You feel very strongly, and you all, importantly, distended sense of time. Yes. Something could have lasted a very long time or lasted a very short time. You don't really know.
Yeah. The telescoping of time.
Yeah.
It speaks to... It's lying on the table, right? At the moment, I'm reading Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit.
Oh, for sure.
And it,
how is it? I've never read Hegel.
It's so difficult. It's like a... Contextually, it's like a famous work of philosophy that is famously incomprehensible, and it is.
He's just a bad writer, right? I think that's the number on Hegel.
The only way I can explain it, he just doesn't explain anything. Things come up, but the big idea from Hegel, right, is like the dialectic, the idea that things that are most opposed, most different from each other, that very opposition is what makes them very similar and very intertwined. And that's why I think Cassavetes is kind of a Hegelian filmmaker, because he's not talking about illusion as or dreams as something separate from reality. He's talking about the dreams in reality. The fact that when we talk about, like, oh, this surreal thing happened, we're still talking about the real.
Yes.
He captures that, right? It's what you're talking about this... Naturalism pushed so far, it's no longer naturalism. It's making a film that makes you feel like you're drunk or stoned or having a bad dream, while never pointing to something outside of reality.
Well, the two of the final scenes in this film really speak to that, I think. So the first one is you're back in the hotel room after the night with these three women. It seemed like... I don't think anyone got laid. It was just all a disaster for everyone.
Yes, everyone had a bad time.
Yeah. They seem to have a new set of people in the hotel. One of whom, I think, Falk propositioned in the casino. Was that the same woman?
No, it's...
It's a different woman. Okay.
Because Zara finds them in, like, a tea shop.
But I thought she was a recurring character. I must be wrong. I thought that Falk had met her in the casino and then Zara had found them.
I don't think so.
Okay, that makes sense. They're just... British woman and one young woman. And that scene is, again, it's just like inexplicable as to why anyone is there. This kind of Cassavetes is asked to do a trick with a cigarette. Does he actually do
no.
it?
No. Well, he does it, but the camera's not pointing at him. Falk is going like, watch his lips, and you're looking at Falk.
And that feels totally alien and estranged and otherworldly. Because it's... I can't even explain why. But then, what I think might be my favourite scene in the entire film is Falk and Cassavetes have returned to New York. And they're standing on the road outside Cassavetes' home, and Fork spends all... They're both holding these, like, just big paper bags, which seems to have been all they've brought back from London. And Fork is like, oh, I need a camera. This is a camera. He pulls out this, like, enormous tourist camera, like this, like the fake kind of cameras you give to kids. The dog's mine. I need a dog. You have three sailor's hats. I need a captain's hat. This goes on for so long, and you realise that these are, like, the presents they brought back for their kids, like these huge bags. And then Cassavetes walks... It's just like
my favorite scene.
The shot
in the film.
Of the daughter walking towards him. And then an older son who is clearly Cassavetes' son, right? Yes. Like a little asshole.
Yeah.
Who's like, oh, you'll be in such trouble with mum. And you never see the mother. And Cassavetes just this wonderful shot of him standing and then walking around the corner to the back of the house.
And the sound drains out and it cuts to black.
Those scenes are very Lynchian. Like, I hate to, you know.
No, they are Lynchian.
They are Lynchian.
I think we should talk about critical reception in a minute because it's really interesting. A lot of the things that critics say about this film, which they kind of called it, like, depraved.
I saw that Ebert didn't like it.
Fucking
wrong about everything.
Wrong about everything. This is the final scene of the film is the antidote to some of the worst stuff in the movie, right?
Because it's, like, really useful.
As you say, Cassavetes walks up his driveway and there's just this shot of his daughter... Who's kind of already crying. She has a tear.
She seems upset, but then she just...
She bawls this, like, really real cry.
I was thinking while watching it, how do you get a child to cry like that?
It's Cassavetes' kid. Like, it's his own kid.
Wow.
So I think that's the reaction of, like, daddy is home. Like, I think it's a reaction playing out in real time. Because the kid just cries and Cassavetes is going like... And as you say, in the background, Cassavetes' son is being like a fucking dick.
Is that his real son? No.
I don't think... Because Cassavetes had quite a few children and one of them is a filmmaker. He made The Notebook, that rom-com, is made by Cassavetes. I have to look it up now.
Goodness.
Yes. And I think his daughter is a filmmaker too. How many kids did he have? I think he had 5. I might be wrong.
Jeez.
No, he had 3.
Okay.
Nick, Alexandra, and Zoe. And Zoe Cassavetes, is a filmmaker herself. And Alexandra, Zan, is the daughter at the end of this film.
Okay.
There's this kind of looming sense that, like, you know, Cassavetes' relationship is in big trouble, but he has a really tender moment with this girl, like a really quiet, shared moment with his daughter, where he seems so exhausted and defeated, but he's genuinely consoling her.
That's the empathy in the film, is that moment.
Yeah.
That's it, though.
That's pretty much it. And it also, I mean, it's an interesting thing to watch for if you do watch more Cassavetes, is that the home is a really big recurrent theme in Cassavetes' cinema. Like, the idea of going home, being at home. In A Woman Under the Influence, you're led to believe one of the reasons that the housewife is kind of having a breakdown is because... she's trapped in this house, so that the home is like a, again, quite Lynchian, like quite a disturbing Jungian kind of symbol of bad stuff. And I think the film ends on this note of is Cassavetes happy to be home?
Yeah.
Will it be bad? You know, it's that real...
It's not necessarily stable.
No.
Again, the film's called Husbands, right? It's like defined by the attachment to something.
I wanted to just quickly talk about these reviews.
Yeah, please.
Because a lot of people who really liked Cassavetes, like some of his champions, hated this film. So the story with Ebert is that...
Had he made many films, like, as an independent filmmaker before this?
This is quite late. So I think, actually, this is... I have to double... See, there's the news blare. We've been here for a fucking hour. Yeah, because if this is post Woman Under the Influence, he gets nominated for Best Director for Woman Under the Influence. Oh, it's not. How interesting. Okay. Huh. So he's only made a couple of films by this stage.
Okay.
He's made Shadows, which was made for, like, no money, and this is his worst film, I think. And then he made a movie called Too Late Blues, which he did for hire, so it's not at all like this. It's like a straight-down-the-middle melodrama. He made A Child is Waiting, which is a melodrama too, about disability in schools, a school for children with disabilities, which is very, like, weepy kind of, like, telemovie of the week. Then he makes Faces, which is very acclaimed and more like this. And then he makes Husbands. So okay. he's kind of just coasting.
Oh, yeah.
And then 4 years later, Woman Under the Influence is the one that gets him nominated for Best Director and Rollins for Best Actor. Like, it's not necessarily good that he takes this kind of critical beating this early in his career.
Sure.
So what happened was Jay Cox of Time
mm-hmm.
wrote a review that said, this is the line, Husbands may be one of the best movies anyone will ever see. It is certainly the best movie anyone will ever live through, which is quite a good.
Yeah.
Ebert wrote about that review, seldom has Time given a better review to a worse movie. So wow. Ebert hated it. His criticism is, it shows an important director not merely failing, but not even understanding why. And there are long passages of dialogue in which the actors seem to be trying to think of something to say.
I mean, that's...
So he's an idiot.
That gives him away, yes, right? As it's like you usual. You could imagine an argument for the first part of that claim. Maybe. It's just like, what are you talking about?
Maybe the worst American critic, Roger Ebert.
I don't think he's a particularly good writer.
No.
I don't think he has any insights. I think he just describes films... incorrectly.
But yeah, like it's really embarrassingly wrong. Yeah,
I don't understand that. He loves cinema. I'll give him that.
I don't know if you can love cinema and be that bad at like understanding what it is. And lots of bad reviews. But one of the most surprising is Pauline Kael. And Kael, Kael, who I like too, who is a big champion of these new Hollywood directors and makes careers based on her reviews and had previously really liked Cassavetes, called the film infantile and offensive.
Which the men are.
I think she is more correct than Ebert, right? That like this film, because it reaches this, it's so unpleasant to watch sometimes.
Yes.
You feel like it can only be like some kind of punk act, right? Like a John Waters film. It feels like smearing excrement on the camera.
You can imagine. I think it would depend heavily on the attitude you entered the cinema with, right? Or you had maybe 30 minutes in. Whether you're like, let's see where this is going, or when will this be over?
Yeah.
As soon as you think one of those things, you're on the path, you know?
And when you're off the train, when you're like, this is film is egregious,
no redemption.
No.
Yeah.
You're only... It is being somewhat reclaimed by stuff like the Criterion release. It just got a Criterion release. And it's now finally being talked about in the way I think it should. Is it raining or is that wind?
I don't know. I don't think it's supposed to rain.
Think it's rain.
Maybe it's rain.
Oh my goodness. Well, the new house has plastic roofing, so you'll have to listen to the sound of the rain.
If you need to get to use like one of those, us instead of one of those rain apps.
Yeah, like a calm app. Yeah. When I was fucking recounting the plot of fucking Husbands while you go to sleep. Do you have any final words before we do the Letterboxd game?
It's one of those films where, like I said at the beginning, would I say I liked it? I mean, yeah, I guess would I say I enjoyed it? I'm not sure. Do I think it's a good film? Absolutely. Would I? I want to watch it again. I want to watch more Cassavetes.
Would you show it to your dad?
It's a very good question. There are elements of it he'd really like. I think
he would get what's going on.
Yeah, he would definitely get what's going on. I think ultimately it would be too much for him.
Okay.
I think he would just want it to be shorter. Sure. I think that would be the problem. Because he would absolutely understand the... Because he likes a lot of new Hollywood stuff.
Yeah.
I should check if he's seen any Cassavetes. Not that vulgarity as such is a necessary turn-off for him, but I think the indulgence in the vulgarity would be difficult for him to take. He would just be like, well, what's... I mean, yeah.
Sure.
Well, he surprises me. He's just finished the second volume of Proust.
Oh, really?
And he likes it, which I would never have picked. Huh. In French.
In French?
He's reading it in French.
Goodness gracious.
He's a real hard to...
I read the first volume of Proust. I don't like it very much.
I understand that. I've only read bits of the first volume, but I would never have picked... I would have thought that would be too indulgent for him. Yeah. Obviously, that's a very different direction to Husbands, but...
I mean, not entirely, right? The similar kind of emotional tenor.
Yeah.
What
did people think about this film on Letterboxd, Joseph?
So, let's do the Letterboxd game quickly. We also have to leave room to quickly read an email.
Yes, okay.
That has been sitting in it. So we'll do a compact version of the Letterboxd game.
Yeah, good idea.
It is fucking raining.
You gave it 5 stars?
I gave it 5 stars.
Yeah, I understand that. I would have a hard time not giving it 5 stars, just because it's so hard to...
Where else do you go?
Like, yeah, but that's the thing. It's like, well, you've...
It's five you've or zero. You've done it. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you did
what
do
you
it.
Wanted to do, you did. But is it worth it?
Yeah, I my guess is 3.6?
3.8.
Okay.
That's what I talk about, right? Like, the reclamation project is in swing. The first review I have to read out to you is a review by a friend of yours and a friend of this very podcast. Oh, yeah. Rhiannon.
Oh, yes. Shout out to Rhiannon.
So, Rhiannon, that rain is fucking It's pretty loud.
How is it coming through?
It's not... It's always louder through the cans. Sure. I have the cans on. It's pretty loud. I think we'll be fine. So, Rhiannon rated this film twice, because I was excitedly watching. Rhiannon gave... The first time around gave the film 3.5 stars, okay. I think, and kind of gave quite a short review. And then this is Rhiannon's follow-up review, okay. Which is 4.5 stars. Actually, I've thought about this some more, and this film rocks. It engages with masculinity in a way not dissimilar to Philip Roth, and the willingness to look directly at these feelings and behaviors makes these men's transgressions all the more damning and pathetic.
Yeah.
Roth is a really good comparison point. The mundanity of their fears and insecurities is both pitiable and universal.
Mm.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Interpersonally, the relationship between powerlessness and agency has to be faced repeatedly, honestly, and from many directions, depending on how someone is threatened. None of these men can do that at any point in the course of this film. They can neither face what they do to others, nor what others have the power to do to them.
Great. Yeah, that's a more articulate than we've been, probably.
Yes, I'm
that's,
sure.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, it's the very... definition of depiction is not an endorsement. Yes, this film, right? Yes, absolutely. And if you walk away from this film
being like, John Cassavetes likes to have some beers, doesn't he?
You don't understand the language of cinema.
Yes, I think that's true.
Maybe.
I didn't do Rhiannon's top four. Rhiannon doesn't have a top four, just has a top four, two, both of which you've seen. Burning.
I love Burning.
I love Burning too. And The Irishman.
Great film. I really want to rewatch Burning. I think about rewatching Burning so often and just haven't.
It's because the ending is just magisterial. Yeah. I think the ending of that film is another level. I really
do. That was I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before, but seeing that alone in a cinema, I think it was like the day after I finished a like long teaching semester or something, or like something, and I just walked to a cinema, watched it. Perfect film to see by yourself.
And perfect film to see during the day too.
Afternoon film.
Great film. I'll give you one positive one, and then I'll give you one negative one. Please. In fact, I might do that in the opposite. I'll give you this as like a little, because we've talked about this before.
Mm.
Adam Friedland.
Oh, yeah.
Dan's best friend.
No. I have no affiliation with any of them.
His favorite film, we've said before, is just Borat. That's the only slot he's used up.
Look, I'll say, I saw Borat in the cinemas as a little child. I laughed a lot.
Yeah, it's a funny
film. However old I was, probably not a little child.
There's some good jokes in Borat.
Yeah.
The funniest joke in Borat, I think, is the bit where he's in the hotel room and there's just a cutaway to him sitting on a chair and being like, I am the king or something.
Yeah.
He says to, it's great.
Good stuff.
Friedland says, I want to be with my boys forever. That's Friedland's review. I mean, this is pretty Cometown adjacent.
Yeah,
right?
It really is.
Yeah, I was going to say which one of us is... Which, but...
I don't know. I think
neither of us is Gazzara, right?
No, I think I might be Falk and you might be Cassavetes.
Yeah, maybe.
But that's not you. There's a lot of ways in which we don't map.
But we are pretty Falk and Cassavetes and Mikey and Nikki. That's
true.
A much more true mapping of who we are as people. Where the fuck is... Someone gave it 5 stars and said this is basically just grown-ups, which is funny. Oh, I saw a really negative one the other day and I wanted to read it. I was prepared. Let me find it. How many people do you think gave this film 0.5 star?
I feel like this is a film... I don't know how many people reviewed it, but it's got to be a solid percentage, right? Like, I feel like if you don't like this film, you really don't like it.
Yes. I think there's lots of 5 stars and there's lots of 0.5 stars. All right, here we go. Didn't you know? This person, I won't read their name out. Their top four films are Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Have you seen that?
No. I've heard... Given it's a film that's supposed to be universally acclaimed, I feel like I've really heard mixed things.
I don't like it.
Yeah, You number among several people I really trust.
Ned hates it. Our mutual friend.
Yeah, but you know why Ned hates it.
Yes, I do.
Because it doesn't correctly represent the history of European art.
Yes, I know. Which is pretty funny. My biggest problem with Portrait of a Lady on Fire is it's this austere period piece that's shot on digital video. It just looks shit.
Yeah.
It looks like Michael Mann's Miami Vice. Like, it looks like latter-day Lynch. It doesn't work.
That's very weird.
It's this disconnect I can't get over. Before Midnight.
Great film. Maybe? Wait.
Before Midnight, the third one.
Oh, but it's in the first one.
I like Before Midnight. It's definitely the weakest, I think.
Okay.
Inside Llewyn Davis, which I'm...
I like that film.
I've
only seen it. I saw it at the movies and haven't seen it since.
It's like bottom quadrant Coen Brothers for me.
Okay.
And Jane Campion's In the Cut, which is an all-time film for me. Yeah, unbelievable. Have you ever read that book, Susanna Moore?
No.
Oh, it's an incredible film, incredible book. So this person's review. Ladies, this is half a star. Ladies, if you meet a man who relates to this film, I'm telling you right now to avoid him, block him, dump him. Which is a good way of exposing your inability to understand what movies are about.
Also, yeah, for sure. I do
relate to these
men.
Yeah, of course I do. I'm not... Am I like them all the time? Do I think that they're valiant or admirable? Yeah. No, but I relate to them. Of course I do.
It's the problem about reducing art to relatability. Yeah. But also thinking about relatability as endorsement. And also...
Thinking about relatability is like all-encompassing.
Yes.
Like you can relate
to... And uncomplex.
Yes. You can relate to a character you share very little with.
Yeah.
Like very little with. Should we read another high review or should we read the low one?
I'd like to hear... Well, maybe another low one and then I'll finish on a high one.
On a high. Justin. Top three films.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
Classic.
Funny film. Apocalypse Now. You know.
It's good.
It's pretty good. I think I kind of like Apocalypse Now less than most people.
That's interesting. I haven't seen it in a very long time.
I like it.
I feel like you have unusual feelings about Kubrick films. Like, you don't love Space Odyssey.
That's Coppola.
Oh, of course. Sorry. Why don't you go Kubrick?
Because Strangelove is
Oh, I'm Kubrick. Thinking of Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I was thinking of,
I don't like Full Metal Jacket. But I am slightly contrarian on Kubrick. Like, I love Eyes Wide Shut the best.
Yeah.
And I really don't like Clockwork Orange, as you say. Have you seen Eyes Wide Shut yet?
No. I'll watch it.
Although I can't really... You did watch Do the Right Thing, so like that should satisfy me for some time.
Yeah, a little while.
Harvey. Have you seen
that? Oh, I saw that at the movies. You know, this episode, if any fan is insane, if you want to go through all the episodes of the Brad Pitt cast and find out... And work out the ratio of films mentioned that I've seen and haven't seen. Mm. I reckon this episode's the highest. I've seen a lot of films we've mentioned.
Yeah, you're doing good. I saw Harvey as a kid. And,
I
liked it. Justin's review. A promising and unconventional start. I mean, you like the start too, right? A photo montage offers some of the only background music in the entire film. The lack of music isn't always obvious and even girds realism, but it emphasizes the brutal length of some of the shots. In theory, I loved the long shots, grimy and shaky, pulling in and out of faces and focus. In practice, it was tedious more often than successful. And while Ebert's lament was focused on the improvised feel of the script, mine is on the casual violence and contempt inflicted on women throughout. It's true.
I'm not going to push back on that necessarily.
It's true that the film contains the things that you're saying, but it's not unaware of them.
No. These are horrible, man.
I bet you, not that I'm a vindictive person, I bet I could scroll through this person's other reviews and find them giving very high ratings to films that are dismissive and violent against women, but aren't in an appointed way. I mean, even Dr. Strangelove is not very... I mean, there's
definitely misogynistic.
A couple of women in that film and they're treated as kind of like harpies. Like, anyway.
The literalization of the kind of way misogyny is made material in this film, while difficult to watch, perhaps, is at least more honest about the nature of misogyny than films that elide it.
I think it's like Come and See, the Alain
Kumar film. I watched the first 20 minutes of that.
And you couldn't do it?
Yeah.
Did you watch it on Criterion Channel? It's up there.
Oh, really? No, I watched it.
Restoration.
I was staying... Well, this is before I moved to Sydney, and I was staying with my family, and my uncle has a pretty extensive DVD collection, and I was like... I was there for like a week, I think, and I was the only person in the house. I'd been left alone. I must have been like a teen. And I was like, I've heard about this film, and put it on and was like...
It must have been a bootlegged copy, because Come and See was famously, until Criterion very recently put it out, very hard to find.
He definitely gets like DVDs from Europe and stuff. Oh, yeah, so.
It would be one of those.
Yeah.
But it's like watching Come and See, which, if you haven't seen it, is like a extremely...
stark.
Difficult, like, Salo levels of violence and kind of pain look at war. But, I mean... seeing husbands and being like husbands is misogynistic feels to me like watching Come and See a film populated with violence and being like, yeah, it's a celebration of war. It's like you just kind of don't really understand what films do.
And maybe I am sympathetic with people who wouldn't want to watch it, I think. But yeah, saying sure. It's bad is a different...
Yeah. Look at this person.
Mm.
This person's top four films are Crash...
okay.
David Cronenberg.
Joseph loves that.
Martha by Rainer Werner Fassbinder. Safe by Todd Haynes.
Joseph.
And Babe Pig in the City.
For real?
And their review is devastated by that ending every time. 5 stars.
Hi. What's their username?
Joseph Earp.
You should follow that person.
Yeah, I should. I think that's true. See, this is kind of a wild review that also just doesn't speak to what the film is about. Well, let's end on this one. Sebastian Zufelt is their name. Pretty interesting top four films. High Fidelity.
I haven't seen that.
I don't think I've seen that either.
Some people were very mad that the TV show got cancelled.
The TV show that does not exist.
I know, right? On like a stream, maybe Prime, maybe Hulu. I don't know.
Speaking of peak TV, did you see that Rachel Weisz is rebooting the David Cronenberg twin gynecologist film Dead Ringers for Amazon Prime?
What a time.
Peak TV is the craziest shit. They'll give money to anyone.
It's really wild.
They'll give money to anyone.
Yeah, you just gotta turn up.
Yeah, you just gotta be there. The Last Days of Disco is this person's other film, directed by Whit Stillman.
Oh.
Who I was really rude to on Twitter, and he was a fucking piece of shit. He said something like, during the Black Lives Matter protests, he said something like, instead of watching 24-hour Antifa news, watch European art house films. And I replied, a take almost as bad as your movies. Just pretty proud of.
That's pretty, yeah. I don't endorse Bring Me on Twitter, but that's pretty funny.
This person's third favourite film is Between the Lines. I've literally never heard of. Joan Micklin Silver. Lots of my friends have reviewed it, never heard of it. And Pierre Le Fou, the Godard film.
I don't know any of those.
The worst Godard film.
Okay.
This review, 5 stars, love heart. Cassavetes really made a movie out of him and his friends vibing, and I respect the hell out of that. Now listen. I don't think that's what this
means. Yeah, I think we have another misinterpretation on our hands.
Imagine watching husbands and being like, just dudes vibing. That's what that film is about. Let's quickly do this.
At such a frequency that they threaten to explode.
Yes, exactly. Vibing like, if that's how you describe...
nuclear rods.
Yeah, if you describe that's how, what happens to the guy in Scanners whose head explodes. Like, if he's vibing... All right, I'm cracking open the email and...
yeah, please.
Reminding people, you can email us. What's our fucking email address?
BradPittCast@gmail.com, because BradPittCast@gmail.com was taken to not email whoever has that
God damn.
Email address.
Oh, did you see, by the way? Did you see we got an email? Oh, we have two emails.
Oh, really?
Three. We have this email. Shoe Gang... Group Co. Limited Company Representative Offer.
Oh.
Greetings. Hello. This is an official request for professional consultants who will stand as our regional representative to run logistics on behalf of Shoe Gang Group.
I missed this.
I'm
blowing up.
Yeah. First one.
Mm.
Desi. Have you read this email?
Yes. But I think I read it when it came through and it's been a little while.
Mm. The 30th. Yeah, just over 2 weeks. First off, I love listening to you guys, and I'm really missing the Brad Pitt cast in my life since you guys took this break. I just finished a long road trip up the east coast of the US, and I think I've now heard every episode in full. Thank you, Desi. It seems that a common topic for your discussion is about what films are saying about America or US culture. Maybe just being inside that culture all the time has made me blind to this topic. Or have you found that most Americans are blind to this idea? I've thought critically about this idea with movies that are very clearly pointing the lease at America, like Dazed and Confused, or of course in school when we discuss it with Great Gatsby type of books. But it's not a topic for every movie. I guess the crux of my question might be, have you seen a difference in how Americans discuss Hollywood films versus how the rest of the world discusses Hollywood films? A really, really interesting question.
It's not something I've ever really attended to.
I think Americans are often less good at noticing things that... which I think is kind of what Desi's speaking to, right? There are films that are pointedly about America, and that's how Americans want to be depicted. But I think Americans are often bad at recognizing the way that a film just kind of smuggles in American attitudes that they might not notice.
I think, well, it's interesting that... it's really interesting that Husbands goes to London, right?
Yes.
Because they could go to Vegas.
Yes.
And they don't. They go to London.
The London thing just kind of feels like deliberately insane.
Or like John Cassavetes wanted to go to London.
Yeah. Did they actually go to London, though? I've always wondered.
No, I mean, the film has so little sense of place.
The only thing that makes you know it's London is that it's raining.
And the rain is definitely fake, I think. But if it's interesting to have... and then it comes up a bit, like someone asks for if his family's here and he says, no, they're in New York. There's very little... there's like this sense of boorish Americans overseas, which is interesting in that film. If we're to think about... I mean, I think we... like, yeah, as Desi says, right? Like, we are interested in Brad Pitt as Americana, whereas Americans are interested in Brad Pitt as Brad Pitt. There's kind of one less... I think often if you look at especially... and it's a shame. Something you often complain about as a film reviewer is the lack of availability for film review, like for you to get on the film review narrative.
Yes.
Because everything goes to America first.
Yes.
I think because of that, there's a kind of lack of conversation around... I mean, you just have to look at Parasite, right? Like the conversation around Parasite as being some phenomenally... like how could a film have such insight into the, you know, nature of, like, class division. And it's just because there's capitalism. It's everywhere. Like, it's not...
Bong Joon-ho said that,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah,
we all live under capitalism. I think... and I'm not being mean to Americans. Because
and we love Americans.
I love Americans. And I love American culture. Like, I did this really embarrassing thing recently where I looked at what percentage... because I log every movie I watch on Letterboxd. And I saw which came from which country... I'm like 62% made, like, my film viewing is American movies.
And I reckon that would be low disgusting. For, like, an average film viewer, to be honest.
Watch so much American culture. But I think Americans kind of... and I've only been to America once, so this is probably really uninformed. I think there's a kind of slight cultural isolation to America.
Definitely.
That, like, Americans... like, don't watch a lot of films from other cultures and don't read a lot of the press from other cultures, understandably, which is very different from how our culture works.
It was... so, I was in America in January, and everyone, including a guy who came to, like, fix something in my hotel room, asked me about the bushfires. Literally everybody I met. And so it was this sudden, like... as if they'd never heard of Australia before. Mm-hmm. Like, the way in which it... and when I would actually tell them about it... the interesting thing is, as soon as I would start telling them the details, they would be, like, astonished by the details of the bushfires. Because they hadn't... they didn't know anything beyond bushfires in Australia, right? Yeah. That's, like... that's the level of content that reaches American shores. Not to slight any of the individuals, right? That's just how, like, the news and news operates over there. But, yeah, I think there is a significant failure to... or maybe failure, whatever. Like, the nature of America is very insular. And I think that... but that what that ends up leading to is a lack of understanding. I think also meta-narratives that go on in cinema. Like, things that might be representing... I think it takes America a long time to be like, oh, look at all the films that came out post 9/11 that were about 9/11. There's a kind of a failure to do big picture stuff. Because everything is so centered on America, they don't have a kind of sense of good global political cultural narratives.
And I think... the reason I think about this, like, American saturation is I think that we're in this weird mode in Australia where our culture is so America-centric, but we don't live in America, so we don't experience the norms as they exist. We don't kind of live with them. But, like, I know fucking so much about American culture. Like, when I meet Americans, they're shocked by the fact that I, like, know who Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is.
Yeah.
Because...
They don't know
who. Do you think most Americans could name a single Australian politician?
Definitely not.
And like that, so that means that I think the reason we talk so much about what it means about America is we know a lot about American culture, but we're at the distance where we don't live in it, we're not saturated in it. So it can still seem kind of weird or noticeable to us.
There's things that, when I have been to America, and each time I've gone, you like forget these things a little bit, but that you, despite watching, and I, especially in my childhood, I absorbed so much American literature and television and film. So it really shaped me and my sensibilities. But I still, for instance, find tipping strange and something to like really adjust to and have to pay attention to. Just even little things. I remember the first time I was in New York, and was that the first? I think it was the first time I was in America. You go to a restaurant, and the entree is the main course. And it's insane that I've watched, like, up to that point, like thousands and thousands of hours of American content. Just had no idea that that's what people meant by entree. So there are these kind of, there is this like, and I say that as an example of the kind of distances there are, despite having that cultural saturation, which, yeah, I think does look... Like, we're still not outside it entirely. I still don't think we can view it with the same, you know, distance as someone from, I don't know, whatever countries have less American saturation.
I have a Bernie Sanders badge. Like, that's crazy. Like, I don't have a badge for politicians from any other country. Like, I wanted to pull out two last things from this email from Desi. One, Desi says kind things about your... skills as a university teacher and lecturer.
Desi was a great student.
And Desi also says, on the topic of taste, every time I think I have Joseph figured out, he says a movie I'm sure he'll hate is a masterpiece, or an I'm sure he'll love is a travesty.
All of us.
So that's always a fun surprise. It's good. It's good to be unknowable.
It is. It's important.
I kind of think I'm more predictable than that, right? Am I slightly less predictable?
I think you are generally predictable. I think just every now and then there'll be a surprise. I think also, did Desi just ask for general recommendations as
for
well?
Movies,
think I'll just say the three that I watched. I'm sure he's seen Do the Right Thing, but the four that are The Devil and Daniel Webster, Do the Right Thing, Gates of Heaven.
Desi really likes Zodiac. So Desi, you should watch the Bong Joon-ho film if you haven't, director of Parasite. You should watch a film he made called Memories of Murder, which, like, Fincher kind of ripped off wholesale for... Not ripped off, because I love Zodiac. That's obviously very inspired by
really
Memories
of Murder. Zodiac at the moment, isn't it?
Zodiac's a fucking masterpiece.
It's a long time since I've seen it. Also saw it in my uncle's place, actually.
Really? Yeah. I think it's the best Fincher. I love that movie so much. The murder scenes in that film are wild. Like, no music, kind of awkward almost.
I'll rewatch.
Incredible. Let's finish with... this incredible email from William.
Love William.
The subject header of this email is, an anagram of Ad Astra is a star ad. That is what the film is. I mean, just perfection.
You guys would really get on.
I'd really love to meet
next time he's in Sydney.
So I'm going to pull out some of the most salient questions from this email. Do you think the title Meet Joe Black was an attempt to turn the film into a catchphrase about dying? As in, geez, I hope I get to visit Paris before I meet Joe Black.
Kick the bucket. Well, you know, speaking of the film The Bucket List popularized the phrase The Bucket List, right? Like, films can do that. I would like that to be the case. I can't remember that director's name now, but it would make sense that he would have that kind of aspiration.
Yeah. I hope so. The scene from that film, Meet Joe Black, which it feels like we covered a lifetime ago. Did we cover that pre-pandemic? No, we covered it over Zoom.
I think that might have been the first pandemic film we covered.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
No, the first one was 12 Monkeys, because that film opens with a deadly virus is killed.
We heralded it.
That scene from that film where Brad Pitt, as Death, watches the fireworks over the birthday party from a distance and gets emotional is very interesting. In, I think, the way it serves as a representation of an attractive man in the late 90s. Brad Pitt's character is sad, perhaps because his holiday is over, yes, but I also think the scene suggests that he is more so finally feeling the weight of A, his duty to do hard things, like kill people, and B, his intimate knowledge of the emotional weight of said duty on both himself and others. He's portrayed as virtuous in the distance he chooses to keep from the crowd in this moment, as in the audience sympathizes with him for his implied restraint on his colossal power. I mean, he's the Grim Reaper. What I am trying to say, the character is interesting because it celebrates the non-use of power more than the use of it, at a time where power, latent, dormant, overt, whatever, in male characters was deeply celebrated, like in The Matrix, Saving Private Ryan, Toy Story, etc. Incredible selection of three films to point to. I really mean that. Especially the representation of men experiencing a drastic increase in their ability to dominate others was and still is a fundamental focus of popular films, like all the Marvel shit. But not really Joe Black. And it hurts Brad Pitt's character. He starts crying. So anyway, I liked it. Tell me if this mini thesis is bullshit.
No, I think it's good.
This little section, in fact, this episode in general, has taught me something which I already know, but it has reaffirmed to me, that our listeners are much smarter than we are. Much more salient. Like Rhiannon
and,
yeah, and Desi too.
And
like,
Will have all made.
Everyone is saying things that we don't see or think about. It's much smarter than anything we fucking
say. As a movie, I felt, to much to Joe's pain, quite mediocre on.
I don't know how you can call anything about me, Joe, like mediocre.
Well, that take makes me kind of want to revisit it because it's such an interesting understanding of Brad Pitt as like character, right? Like as leading man, as protagonist, as man.
It's a good film.
Yeah,
it's a good film. All right, the big one is what Will says. Why doesn't Dan rate films as highly as Joe?
Almost always.
It's a good question. Yeah, has that have? I mean, I guess it, like only when I really hate something.
Yeah, I feel like I liked A River Runs Through It more than you, but that was like a half a star, one star kind of situation.
And Malick, right? When you like Malick,
that's
right.
Although I've only seen the two Malick films I've seen. One you haven't seen, and the other one is Badlands, which you don't mind, right?
I don't like that
film. Okay, I like it. I think it's great. But yeah, anyway, sorry.
It's become a running thing on the podcast, and I really have no real business telling you your business. But of course,
please,
you do.
Will.
But my theory for the difference in your Starwise ratings of films is thus. Dan's ratings are drawn foremost from the performances of actors. Joe's ratings are drawn foremost from the performances of directors.
It's very interesting. Well, it also... So, a person we talk about a lot, maybe too much on this podcast, but is a good indicator for this, I think, is David Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Lynch... Everyone is acting strangely, but you know more or less they are meant to be. And so it almost gives me permission to like back off on the like, this is unconvincing, mm-hmm. or like this feels... it's really interesting.
I think we have...
It's, again, I'm not sure if it's exactly right, but definitely gets to something.
I think there's two points in it that are definitely true. One is that I am far too director obsessed. I think it's like actually a problem for me because like I don't know if I fully subscribe to the auteur theory. Like I think films can get away from directors.
I think you're interested in films as collaborative and like unwieldy enterprises.
I never talk about it like that though. I'm so...
Yeah.
I talk about things as director's filmographers.
That is really interesting.
To my detriment. I think the performance thing, though, gets to... I think we just have very different takes on acting. I like really stiff acting,
well, you never do.
You
like the person being revealed in the actor, which I think is why it makes sense that we're doing a podcast about Brad Pitt, right? Because Brad Pitt is both a moving and can often kind of, not always, but often convincing and, like, very... changeable and adaptable actor who always very clearly reveals something of himself.
Mm-hmm.
So he almost functions as the intersection of those two understandings of what acting is. Does that make sense?
I think that's true.
Because I think, yeah, like...
They overlap in that.
Yeah. Like, I really like... I mean, maybe, I don't know why I'm thinking about this, but, like, we were talking about Burning earlier. I'm obsessed with Steven Yeun's performance in Burning.
I mean, that's an unbelievable performance.
And I'm obsessed with it because it's so cryptic.
Yeah.
Like, both the character is kind of hidden and the... But he, as an actor, just inhabits it in a very threatening and unsettling and, like, beautiful way.
He supports any reading you want to make of that film. That's the masterpiece of that performance. Like, no... maybe light spoilers for Burning, but... If you either think he's malicious or just kind of lazy and rich, either reading works.
Definitely. And I think I like that because he vanishes into it. I like actors vanishing into performances. And in Husbands, these actors vanish. And, like, you see the blurring of the lines, as you say, on the Dick Cavett show.
Cassavetes is like a... I, yeah, we didn't say this right, but I think some of the performances in these films are like top 10 technical performances. So yeah, so I can like both, but you rarely like both. You like good acting. I like good acting and also acting that's a revelation.
Well, like, I don't like... And I'm not just saying this... I'm saying this because it's the first thing that comes to mind, not because he's been cancelled. But Kevin Spacey in Seven, I find, like, hammy and unhealthy. I don't like that performance.
I love that performance. I think we disagree.
What are performances you don't like? Can you think of any from Pitt Films?
From Pitt Films? Oh, yeah. I think... Like, I think Hopkins is really bad in...
Not Meet Joe Black.
No.
What was the other one? I mean, if you ask me the list of films we've done, I'd say I'd get half of
the
them.
The Bear one.
Yeah. But that's...
Legends of the Fall.
I kind of enjoy Hopkins in that film. Yeah, at the end.
We've just thrown everything out.
When he shoots just the... That's very funny.
That scene is funny. Who is bad? I don't know.
No, I agree with
that. I don't like Christian Bale in American Psycho. That's like a big one that comes to mind because a lot of people like that performance. I think he's unconvincing. But I'm...
You know, I don't know if I've seen that film or not. I feel like I've seen the business card scene so many times and I've read the book twice. I just don't know if I've seen the film.
I don't like the film as much as the book.
This has been a long episode.
I know.
It's fine. I feel like we can give the...
We're back.
We've been gone for a while. I think it's
good. It's not been that bad. It's 1:44. Okay, we'll cut it down.
Yeah.
Can we have a 45-second spoiler corner on Burning?
Yeah.
If you haven't seen Burning, skip ahead to like a minute from here. I think I just now have realized something about Burning.
Oh yeah.
When the Yun character is talking about like burning down greenhouses, it's a metaphor for killing people. And Yun doesn't realize that, and he takes it really literally, and that's why he goes around looking at greenhouses.
Well, not Yun, the other guy.
Yes. Is that really it? I never realized that.
That's funny, because to be honest, normally I'm disastrous at knowing and recognizing that.
Okay, so Yun is talking in metaphors and he takes it like very literally. Yeah. Fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Brianna's coming in, so let's like have Brianna opening the door as our wrap-up. Yes. Thank you so much for joining
us. It's wonderful to be back.
It's lovely to be back. Brianna's here talking to Ida the dog. Hi, Brianna.
Hey.
How are ya?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
I'm good. Do you want to say the sign off? Do you want to say thanks for listening?
Yeah, sure. Just, what do you guys usually say?
You just got to come to the table. What do we usually say?
We say we love you, I think.
I think we do. You got to say next episode is the Charlie Kaufman film Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
I guess I just said it.
I can't remember the name of the film already, but no doubt you guys will. Goodbye.
Bye. We love you. Ida's also standing here. Look at this. It's like the fucking last scene of a sitcom. Bye. See you next week. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind.
Yeah.
And next time. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, directed by George Clooney.
Dan doesn't remember the name of
it. It's a good movie. Dan hasn't seen it.
All right.
No. Bye. Love you. I missed ya.
Yeah, definitely.
See ya.